This is KZFR 90.1 Chico, and you are listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological.
This afternoon, we'll be talking about the housing update of the Chico General Plan. The next community meeting will be held on Wednesday, August 11th, 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m.
And our guest will be Brendan Vieg. He is the Director of Community Development for the City of Chico and Marie Demers, Housing Manager in the Community Development Department.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Certified Farmers Markets, featuring three markets in Butte County. Year-round markets in Chico at the North Valley Plaza on Wednesday morning, at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico on Saturday morning. There is also a seasonal market in Paradise on Tuesday morning. Chico Certified Farmers Markets, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. And we want to remind you that the opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KCFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers.
We'll be back to talk about Chico's general plan and the update of the housing element of the general plan in just a moment. This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico.
We always wanted a big two-story house, back when we lived in that little two-room shack.
We wanted fame and fortune, and we'd live life the way the rich folks do.
We knew somehow we'd make it together, me and you,
with dreams and hopes of things to come. We worked and never stopped. Not much time for you and me. We had to reach the top.
We bought that big two-story house and soon became the envy of the town.
With all our work behind us, we'd finally settle down.
Beauty all around us like we've never seen before. There's chandelier. somehow left love.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, and with us by telephone now are Brendan Vieg. He is the Director of Community Development for the City of Chico, and Marie Demers, who is the Housing Manager in the Community Development Department. Welcome to both of you, Marie and Brendan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'd like to start with some basics. What's the purpose of the general plan? Why do we have one?
All right, I'll open with that. This is, again, Brendan, Community Development Director for the City of Chico. And so, first of all, I guess a general plan is something that's required by state law for all California jurisdictions. And mm-hmm. So that would be cities, towns, and counties. And I like to think of a general plan as kind of a 20-year blueprint for how and also where a community will grow. It's intended to be kind of a shared community vision. I've also heard other folks refer to it as a community's constitution, in that it provides the policy framework for decision-making both by the council, but also for cities' advisory boards, like the Planning Commission and the Architectural Review Board, and other groups like the Airport Commission as well. And then a general plan also is an opportunity to direct a number of work programs for the city, or kind of policy directives. So I like to think of things, I'll give a couple examples, like developing a bike master plan.
Right.
Or providing affordable housing, something I think we're going to talk about more tonight. The acquisition of open space, maybe master planning for police facilities, for example, or creating design guidelines that might be focused on things like infill development. The point is there could be a multitude of other efforts, and they're all outlined in the general plan as priorities and things we need to move forward on.
And so it's a huge vision. I mean, it's a really big thing.
You suggested that there are other multiple elements, like the airport, the parks, and so forth. What are some of the other elements in the general plan?
So, good question. So, again, I mentioned state law kind of directing and dictating what needs to be in a general plan. So there are 7 mandatory elements: land use, circulation, housing, conservation, open space, safety, and noise. Those are the ones that are required by state law to be included. But then a community has an opportunity to include optional elements. And so, for instance, Chico has a number of optional elements. We have put sustainability as one of our elements. It's not just one of them. It's our first element. It's kind of a guiding element of our general plan.
Mm-hmm.
Other optional elements that are included for City of Chico are community design, you know, representing a greater emphasis that we want to have a built environment that is something we're proud of. Downtown is another element, something we cherish, of course, downtown. Economic development, parks, public facilities and services, and then there's another element, cultural resources and historic preservation. So we've got these other optional elements that are wrapped around the mandatory ones. And so, again, I want to just highlight those were all incorporated as part of our general plan update back in 2011 because those were priorities for the community. So here's the twist. Is all of these different elements, as you mentioned, this large document with all these different goals, policies, and actions must be internally consistent with each other.
Yikes.
And so that can sometimes be difficult. You know, you're trying to balance the goals of the elements, which sometimes appear, at least on face value, to be in conflict. And so I got a couple of good examples. One, for instance, is there's support for development. We have a land use diagram that says, hey, this is where and how we're going to grow to meet our jobs and housing needs, but then we also have goals and policies that require preserving open space. Another one that I think there's been conflict over the years in our community has been this promotion of infill, which is well-founded and important, but then we also want to retain neighborhood character. So again, there needs to be this balance.
Right. And the general plan is updated, the whole plan is updated how often, and then the elements are updated how often?
So, Yeah, this is, it's not black and white.
Okay.
General plans, when you kick one off, they're intended to serve a 20-year horizon. So we call our current general plan, we call it the 2030 general plan. It was adopted, it's kind of a nice, clean, neat name, you know, especially mm-hmm. back when it was adopted back in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
It was also updated fairly comprehensively in 2017. But a key indicator, as you mentioned, was like, you know, when do you update a general plan? So a comprehensive update for a general plan is usually when there's a determination that there's a need for some additional land to meet, for instance, jobs and housing needs. Or another key indicator is when there's a general agreement that there's an outdated or stale policy framework. What you've laid out, and there's been some general agreement from the community and the policymakers of the community, it's no longer working.
Right.
So that's the general background for general plans. But then there's a kicker. State law requires that for the housing element of the general plan, it must be updated on an 8-year cycle. Hmm. And this is, again, a very specific time frame that includes specific analysis and requirements, and it also has to be closely coordinated with the California Department of Housing and Community Development.
Right.
So, again, just want to highlight, there are also things that happen in the interim on an annual basis where the state passes new legislation that requires general plan maintenance. There's always something changing. And so recent examples, for instance, include the need to update our safety element. We need to include some identification of 200-year floodplains. There's some new wildfire hazard areas, as you could imagine, with
yes.
all the fires going on. There's new mandates from the state saying, hey, we need to really heighten awareness through the general plans of where those areas are. And then there's also some updates. We're currently in the process of adding more climate adaptation and resiliency actions, also in the safety element. And so, again, I'm just kind of highlighting that there are comprehensive updates to the general plan, you know, multi-year, even multi-million-dollar engagement, community input. There's also the housing element requirements. But there's also minor updates that need to be addressed kind of on a regular basis as directed by the state.
How did the campfire affect people's notion of what needs to be done with the general plan, staff or city council or citizens? What kinds of adjustments need to be made because of the campfire?
So I wouldn't say the campfire itself. For instance, the campfire starts... We're not all running to the general plan to figure out what to do. So it's not like that type of document. You know, there's more hazard plans and other plans in place by our first responders. But on the back end of that, kind of at the state level, I think there's a desire, for instance, that there were areas, for instance, Paradise, where there were fire hazards. And I think people were generally aware, but maybe that wasn't kind of being put forefront in our general plans and being highlighted. And so that's where we did see some legislation that said, hey, we have these fire hazard areas, wildfire hazard areas.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the state is updating those maps because I think they're determining that they weren't at the micro level enough. They weren't contemplating changes in climate change or changes in wind conditions. They weren't, you know, micro level enough. And so they're saying, hey, we're updating our maps. We want you to then take those updated maps, incorporate them, and overlay them over the areas that you intend to develop to make sure you're aware there are some impacts there, and that if the kind of development might occur, there needs to be certain heightened building standards that would be applied. So it's kind of a bigger look than it's not just the campfire. It's, I think, the fires in general throughout California and the West.
What about the population changes that accompanied the campfire and the additional people who came to Chico, is that stable now? And do we have to work with those numbers? And I guess we'll be talking about this a little bit as we go along.
Sure. No, but that's an interesting question because it kind of came up. So we had a general plan that had a build-out population assumption of 2030 of around 130,000 people. That was premised, though, upon a fairly aggressive and conservative assumption of 2% growth rate for the city of Chico. We have seen nothing like that
right.
even since the adoption of the general plan. It's been more in the 1 to 1.5% range. So, again, the notion of the influx of the population that came in with the campfire, albeit the speed was quite quick, as we know, mm-hmm. There is this notion that that kind of population is contemplated by the general plan, just not at that speed. However, working with our regional planning agency, the Butte County Association of Governments, you know, there's been some newest kind of projections for population, and there's a strong belief, and I think there's agreement from the city of Chico, at least from me, that while we will continue to see an increase in housing production, both multifamily and single family, that there still is this belief that people are going to continue to migrate out. The folks that came in, okay. You know, with that influx of 20,000 people, we didn't suddenly build units to accommodate all that, as you are aware. So there's this kind of hidden population, I think, that still exists within the community.
Yes.
That's, again, feeding this kind of hunger for housing.
Yes.
But that there are also people that will continue to leave, and so we'll kind of flatline around 111 to 112,000, even from now through 2030.
So, and that's under the percentage that was projected?
Okay. That is correct.
I'm wondering if there are actually teeth in the general plan. Once it's done, is there enforcement? Are city council members obligated to consider it and put it into action?
So let me give a little background first, because I want to share, like, you know, the housing element, we're starting to get into that, and it's
right.
Kind of
yes.
A relationship with some of the other general plan elements. And so, you know, again, the housing element itself is just one of the chapters or elements of the general plan. And so one of the key linkages of the housing element is to the land use element, which is one of the mandatory elements I mentioned. And it's linked to that because we have to make sure we have an adequate supply of land in order to meet our housing needs for the future. And so there has to be an adequate supply of both vacant and residentially designated land to help Chico meet its fair share of housing units. That's kind of a term that comes out of the state, the fair share of housing. The term they use from the state is known as our regional housing needs allocation. We throw around the acronym RENA number, which is, you know, the short form of regional housing needs allocation. And so that's something that's required by state law. So that RENA number or regional housing needs allocation, there's a process that we go through where first the state, through the Department of Housing and Community Development, allocates a specific number of housing units to the county. To Butte County. And then those are broken down into different affordability levels, very low income, moderate income, and above moderate income. And so our regional planning agency, as I mentioned earlier, the Butte County Association of Governments, they then coordinate with all the jurisdictions. So that's, you know, Paradise, Chico, Oroville, Gridley, Biggs, as well as the county. And they kind of divvy up the fair share for those different jurisdictions. And so then we use that fair share allocation to determine and then build our housing element around. So we're trying to build a plan that can accommodate those units that have been given to us by the state. So regarding your question then about whether it's binding, do we need to ensure that we build those number of units? I'll just say, you know, over the years I've heard possible need for threats from the state to withhold certain types of funding from local governments if they fail to make progress towards meeting those numbers. But I've never heard of it ultimately happening. But I guess I'm starting to believe, you know, there's been a lot of legislation over the last 4 or 5 years, more than I've ever experienced in my role in planning. And it's again, focused on the state housing crisis. And I believe the state will look to put more teeth into meeting those production goals. But here's kind of the kicker. You know, the city or cities generally aren't the ones that build the housing. We control one aspect of the development process, and that's usually developing the plans mm-hmm. and creating regulations. Mm-hmm. So there are some bad actors in California, some bad acting communities that generally they seek to restrict development in their communities by enacting kind of more restrictive regulations or having high impact fees, which can lead to limiting housing production. Generally, those are kind of the communities you would find in the more affluent coastal communities. And that's usually who HCD, the state agency, Housing and Community Development, or in some cases the governor, I've heard some rhetoric, are after those kind of communities. I don't feel that's the case in Chico. I think we're very supportive of proposals that are consistent with our general plan and that kind of continue to meet our goals of housing and jobs.
So this kind of repeats what you just said about the city's role in housing. This is from the 214-222 description of the purpose of the housing element, and it says, a key part of the housing element lays out strategies to address the needs of community residents that are not typically met by the private market. Over the years, Chico housing elements have outlined strategies to provide housing for low-income households, seniors, homeless individuals, and people with disabilities. The city does not directly build affordable housing, but facilitates production by guiding zoning policies, providing funding, and partnering with developers, lenders, and nonprofits. So can you talk a little bit more about that, about the strategies that the city uses to provide housing, for example, for low-income seniors, homeless, and disabled citizens, and how has the city done at facilitating these housing, fulfilling these needs, and is this an I'm sure I know the answer to this, but I want to double check. Will this be an ongoing goal in the housing update?
Hi, sure. This is Marie. I can speak to that. The city can and has committed housing financial resources to leverage state and federal funding, making developers applications for additional funding more competitive. So we have been or are financially involved in 44 single-family and multifamily projects since 1983, and we've facilitated 1,800 units of affordable housing with those investments. Additionally, we've supported the development of 223 shelter beds. So this is something the city will continue as we receive funds that are specifically for the facilitation of housing. We get funds from the federal government, the federal home funds, community development block grant funds can be used for infrastructure type things. They can't be used to build the housing, but they can certainly support the development of the housing. And then we also have sort of the residuals of the former redevelopment agency, which is called the Affordable Housing Fund. We do have those funds. It's very limited compared to what we used to have, but for instance, at the peak, we received $6 million in redevelopment funds just for the production of affordable housing. And now it takes us several years to accumulate, a million for that same purpose. So definitely something that we, would continue doing as it's necessary.
Did we get COVID emergency funding that could be directed toward affordable housing? Are there other sources now as a result of the pandemic that give the city more options for housing?
So in terms of the COVID funding, we did get some community development block grant coronavirus funding, but due to the nature of that funding, there's just a lot of strings involved and timeframes. So it was more appropriate to utilize those funds for public service activities. For instance, CHAT received a good amount of funding so that they could continue some of their housing programs, and then we were also able to provide, for more immediate needs, especially like early in May of 2020, there were some agencies that all of a sudden had a huge increase in needs, such as like Meals on Wheels, Catalyst had needs, everybody kind of had specific needs related to coronavirus, so not so much for actual housing. However, the American Rescue Plan, which was just enacted by Congress in this early spring.
Correct.
There are some funds that are going to be coming down. They're home American Rescue Plan funds. We do not have the specifics on exactly how we're going to be able to utilize those, so that is definitely pending. We've got about approximately $1.9 million in those funds.
But there are some other funding sources from the campfire, mm-hmm. some disaster relief funds,
right,
that will be available to Chico over the next 5 years. Chico itself is going to be allocated over $32 million for multifamily projects to serve primarily low to moderate income housing. Those are some of those areas that we had mentioned earlier about meeting our RENA numbers. And then Butte County has an allocation of $61 million in funds for that same purpose, and we think that a large amount of that money may also be utilized within the Chico city limits, basically because we have a lot of availability of existing infrastructure and more vacant land, you know, designated for multifamily. So there is help on the way, I guess, to answer your bigger question.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask also, we keep hearing that the state is flush with cash, had a windfall year. Is there any movement in that direction to help with housing?
So in terms of state funding, we know that there has been a lot allocated. To be honest with you, I have not looked at the state budget yet to sort of see, I think that the agencies that are going to be controlling those funds, they have not gotten out any kind of guidelines for specifically what those funds are and what they're to be used for. Mm-hmm. But on the federal level, due to the Camp Fire and then the North Complex fires last year, there has been a huge increase in low-income housing tax credits, which is the primary funding source for multifamily housing, affordable, meaning subsidized housing mm-hmm. that really gets to assist those folks who are at more the extremely low or low income and very low.
I'm curious about how do you city guys hook up with the developers who can and will do this kind of work? How do those relationships come about?
Well, so the city of Chico has actually a long history of partnering with affordable developers. And I want to just back up for a minute and sort of talk about the term affordable.
Yes, please. That's because it is.
Yeah.
Used in different ways.
I mean, affordable with, you know, sort of a lowercase a, generally, if housing is affordable, it means that a household is paying 30% of their income to housing expense, or up to 35% in a home ownership situation. When we speak of affordable, like with a capital A, mm-hmm. In particular, those income groups that we mentioned in the housing element, that is going to be primarily housing that is subsidized in some way, because there's just no way for a developer to build housing, especially now with the increase in costs right. of both land and materials and supply issues, to be able to build housing that, you know, where you can charge a rent that is going to be affordable to a lower income person or extremely low income person. So you've got to have something else. You've got to have subsidies. You've got to have zero debt or low debt loans so that you're able to charge rents and still be able to operate that project sustainably and efficiently, but you know, at rents that are going to be affordable to those households.
So we have market rate housing developers in our community, and we also have affordable housing developers both in our community but also outside of our communities. And with the influx of some of the funding sources we mentioned and the tax credits, they are in touch with us as we are in touch with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Could you talk a little bit more about how the incentives work, like tax credits or low interest loans? Who's actually getting the credit there? And how does the money, you mentioned multiple millions that are available to you, how do those millions get to the developers or perhaps to the renters?
So the way it works is, like for instance, with the tax credit projects. So we had actually, let's see, there were 7 projects that applied in 2020. And when I say that, I mean that there's an affordable housing developer who's, this is their forte. It's certainly not every type of developer's forte, because these affordable projects require typically cobbling together many different funding sources. And then there's a long-term commitment. There's a 55-year commitment to provide this housing for this population. So if it was easy, everybody would be doing it, and certainly not everybody's doing it. And so what happens is the developer will typically reach out, figure out it goes both ways, actually. Either the developer will reach out or we'll reach out. We'll say, hey, we've got this particular goal, and we need this type of housing, which is actually sort of what happened with the Creekside Place project. I'll talk a little bit about that. That was sort of the county had funding, the city had a need and had some funding. CHIP, Community Housing Improvement Program, was the local developer willing to take that on. And so typically what happens is the developer will, there's that communication, and then there's, okay, so what funding sources can we utilize to be able to bring this housing to fruition? So in this particular situation, it's a project that's going to serve 100 seniors who 62 and older.
And this is Creekside, right, Marie?
Right, Creekside Place, across the street from Marsh Junior High. They've broken ground. They're going gangbusters. And 15 of the units are going to be reserved for folks who have mental health issue and are homeless or at risk of homelessness. And part of that is that's being funded by through the county and through the state, No Place Like Home funds. And for that project, for instance, that took the county, the city, the Housing Authority of Butte County, because they are providing long-term subsidies through project-based vouchers like Section 8. And then they had to apply for the tax credits through the state. And what happens is, as a nonprofit, they have no use. They don't have a tax liability. So what happens is they get into a partnership typically with an investor. And that investor partner is the one who utilizes those tax credits over a 10-year period.
So Marie mentioned cobbling these things together. So, for instance, the city brought a long-term land lease at zero cost. And we also brought funding to the project. So you really have to bring all these different resources together to make these projects long-term affordable.
I want to hear more about what's going on there, but I just wanted to ask this one question because I've been really curious about it. The website, the Housing Update website, says that the update includes qualitative analysis to, number one, ascertain demographic and socioeconomic conditions, number two, inventory local resources such as developable land, financial resources for housing development, and energy conservation opportunities, number three, analyze governmental and non-governmental constraints to development, and number four, assess impediments to fair housing. And has that work already been done in the housing update? And who does that work? And then what happens to these analyses?
Okay, so sure. So we began last fall.
Yes.
When we hired a consultant, Housing Tools.
Yes.
And they're basically doing the heavy lifting and shepherding the process. So they have done quite a bit of all of those items that you mentioned, inventorying local resources. They've done the demographic studies. They're in the middle of doing the fair housing assessment. The state has added quite a heavy lift in that regard this year, so that's in process. And one of the first tasks is to review the previous housing element and see what progress has been made. And so from there, we... along with community input, we had one community meeting. We had a survey. There's going to be another meeting that I'm encouraging all your listeners to participate in on August 11th. And all of that information informs the draft goals, policies, and actions that would be recommended in the housing element update to address our housing needs.
And so let me just chime in a little bit, too, because those things that Housing Tools are supporting us with and helping and coordinating with us, for instance, the housing needs assessment, all the demographic information, that helps us determine what are our greatest needs, what areas, what age groups, what types of folks are most in need. The adequate sites inventory that you mentioned, that's, again, do we have an adequate supply of vacant land appropriately designated to meet our future needs? So that's kind of a very, I don't know if you're familiar with GIS, but we use our mapping system, we work with our consultant, we identify vacant land. We really want to make sure that we have enough, not, you know, the housing element cycles 8 years, so that's kind of what we're focused on in the RENA number, but we want to have more than just an 8 year kind of a supply. And then the constraints analysis, you know, it's broken down into two areas. There's the governmental constraints. We need to kind of look at ourselves and say, hey, are we putting up impediments? Do we have regulations or do we have excessive fees that are an impediment to the development of housing? And then there's also the non-governmental constraints. And I think Marie had mentioned earlier, things like the price of land, the current cost of building supplies, which are going up, they're skyrocketing, availability of workforce. And then we also still have just neighborhood resistance to projects. We have some projects that have been improved recently, and there is one form of a litigation or another. So these are kind of real constraints to the provision of housing. And then again, as Marie mentioned, probably most importantly of all is getting the public input on what are the policies and programs we need to prioritize and implement to meet these needs, but we have to recognize there are limited resources. And so we really want to be laser focused and get the best, really focus on what will get us the biggest bang for the buck.
Within that, or in addition to that, do you look at changing zoning or changing permitting based on other kinds of needs or other possibilities? One of the things I was thinking about is a lot of communities are working on having in mixed-use housing, having businesses and stores and commercial enterprises downstairs with housing above those places. And does that can you take commercial places and create zoning that will allow that kind of development?
So the answer is yes, we can, and we have. Honestly, our 2011 general plan was fairly enlightened, I like to think. There were a number of goals, policies, and actions that were included that resulted in major amendments to our code, our municipal code, which are what serves as our development standards and regulations. The general plan kind of provides the vision, and then our municipal code is like the real implementation, the meat and potatoes, the specifics. And so we did significant amendments to those standards and regulations that promote and allow mixed-use development throughout the city, that allow and give allowances for higher density along our major corridors, things like emphasizing residential development in downtown. We have major regional commercial areas along Highway 99, kind of the North Valley Plaza Mall, the mall, those kind of areas where affordable housing, or I'm sorry, multifamily housing, which can also be affordable, is allowed. It may require, for instance, a use permit to allow the residential development on the ground floor. I think it's just something you kind of want to keep tabs on. That's why the use permit. But it's not overly burdensome, and it's kind of greater allowances. It's kind of maybe this is an opportunity to highlight, we also have been receiving some additional funding from the state through two grant programs. One's called SB2. The other one's called LEAP, Local Early Agency Planning, I think, is the acronym. And they total about $600,000. We've used a significant portion on the upfront to kind of promote accessory dwelling units and provide free accessory dwelling unit prototype plans that are pre-approved by the city, and those are available on the city's website. But we're also going to look at opportunities to further streamline our code and requirements. We still have some kind of areas where we think maybe we don't need it to require a use permit for multifamily in like the office residential zoning district. There's some areas we need to kind of look at. So we are always looking at streamlining and making our code more supportive of allowing outright affordable or multifamily housing, I should say.
Do you have like visionary developers who look at a place? I think of like the Kmart parking mall, which I mean the old Kmart and that huge parking lot, and you do you have visionary developers and say, I could make a really cool little village here with housing and commercial operations? Are those people around, and do they come to you with those kinds of ideas?
Well, I like to think maybe not that particular example that you're providing.
Right.
But we do have all the stuff that's going on in Merriam Park.
Yes.
Where we're really getting mixed use and we're getting a variety of housing types and, you know, cottage courts and things like that. And you see some of the residential above the commercial. So we do get folks like that. And so we're very supportive of all variety of development types. But that is a special area that, you know, that vision kind of came back, believe it or not, back in 2006. And we're really seeing it come to fruition now.
That's cool. I want to get back to your work on affordable housing because Maria got started with Creekside. But I know that the city of Chico has some other affordable housing projects underway. Can you tell us a little bit more about what kinds of partnerships or what kinds, first of all, the kinds of things you have going on, but then the kinds of partnerships and relationships that you've developed to, and where they are kind of in the process of when they'll be available?
Sure, yes. Additionally, so the city has been able to actually financially participate in three projects that were awarded tax credits in 2020. And then we're participating in another one that has applied for tax credits in 2021. And those projects are the North Creek Crossing project. That's the 106 family units in phase one. And then it'll be 54 units in phase two. And those are to be located in Merriam Park on the north side of the Little Chico Creek there. And they should have broken ground already last week, I believe. I haven't been out there, but I'm pretty sure they broke ground. So those units, as well as the units at Creekside Place, should be coming online at the end of 2022, early 2023. We'll see those units be available then. And we will include information on our website to be able to notify people about that, who to reach out to when those units become available. The additional project that the city has funding in is the redevelopment of 1297 Park Avenue, which is the former Jesus Center.
Mm-hmm.
And that one will be 58 affordable units for special needs households. And a portion of the units will have project-based vouchers for deeper affordability. North Creek Crossing is also going to have some of the project-based vouchers, and so that will make it more affordable to folks on the very extremely low end of the income spectrum.
So do people...
Now, the city hasn't provided funding, but there are four other projects for another 471 units, and they're in various stages of development. The Lava Ridge is the furthest east on Native Oak Drive, up kind of parallel to Highway 32, as you're heading toward Forest Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
That one is under construction right now. You'll see that they've gone vertical. There are walls and it's happening. Let's see. The others are still kind of in getting permitted, et cetera.
But the city did coordinate with them, mm-hmm. provided letters of support, provided assessments and estimates on fee estimates and things. And then there are some of the other affordable projects that were getting those vouchers we had mentioned earlier. So, again, it's kind of a time. It's an exciting time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Never,
right now.
Yeah.
We really had a dearth of activity over the last 6-7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a time where we're ramping up and coordinating with anybody that wants to work with us, because this is a moment in time and we really need to take advantage of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I've never seen this much, this many resources come.
Mm-hmm. Encouraging.
I'm going to, we're running, starting to run out of time, Brendan. But one of the things you talked about early really is something that I think about a lot, and that is, you know, the interrelatedness of all of these parts of the various parts of the city plan. And the kind of climate concerns and the worries about CO2 emissions and that sort of thing How do you take those into consideration? You know me. I'm concerned about how far out we're building. I'm concerned about urban sprawl. And I'm wondering how we work with those two aspects of trying to control, you know, moving out and creating more CO2 and more vehicle miles traveled with the need for housing.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes life's perspective. You know, I really do believe that the general plan seeks to create a compact urban form, which then it's acknowledging that infill is important, but it also suggests that, hey, we need to accommodate. You know, we're talking about housing and housing production. We talked about how the city itself doesn't produce the housing. So we need to create an environment where there's an opportunity for folks to proceed, you know, and develop some new areas. And so what we have outlined is, okay, we support infill, we support mixed use, and where we're going to have new development in a greenfield area, we're looking for something special, something more mixed use, something where people don't need to be just suburban sprawl and they all have to hop in their cars to get to those different services.
Right.
And so for our special planning areas, there's generally a requirement for a mix of uses. The general plan also dictates and says, hey, we need good, high-quality, multimodal transportation infrastructure. Infrastructure either retrofitted or new that seeks to meet the needs of the vehicle, the pedestrian, the bicyclist, but also transit. And then we also, in our general plan, I had mentioned, leads with the sustainability element. It says we need to have an up-to-date current climate action plan, mm-hmm. which outlines strategies and actions that will help the city meet its greenhouse gas reduction goals, which, by the way, are consistent with the state's very aggressive goals.
Mm-hmm.
To that end, we are in the middle of that process. So there's a plug for the Climate Action Plan update, which the draft for public review and a supporting environmental document will be available next week. Look for a notice in the paper for a review. And so that's also a high priority. It's, again, that balance I mentioned. You know, how can you have some development? How do you make it special? Try to get density out of it. Also have the infill, but then also have strategies in place to help you reduce the greenhouse gas emissions so that we're doing our part. And so, again, I think you probably also are aware that the city created a standing commission, the Climate Action Commission,
yes.
to help implement and drive that process.
Yes.
So it's a balance. It's, you know, something where people feel we have too much land made available. And trust me, there are people that think we do not have enough land available. And so I still believe the vision that was established in 2011 and that general plan and that land use diagram is functioning well, and I think we're moving in the right direction.
We haven't talked about one of the many elephants in the room, and that is the unhoused. Can the general plan address homelessness? Will it address homelessness? And what sort of provisions might it allow or encourage?
Well, I guess first off, our department and then through the housing element, you know, we make sure the municipal code gets updated to conform to state law. For instance, you know, the code is updated to allow shelters, transitional and supportive housing in all residential areas. And, you know, the housing element is about making sure that there's going to be production of permanent housing units.
Mm-hmm.
So increasing the supply in general will allow more households to find more appropriately priced housing. And I think especially right now with this great opportunity for all of these affordable developments to have resources available, it will certainly help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is also supporting and bringing funding towards, for instance, things like expansion of the tourist shelter.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a variety of ways. And then there's the service providers.
Right.
So every year, maybe Marie can speak to this better than I, but, you know, we are allotted money from the federal government, and then we pass that through to the service providers that are on the front lines, really helping address homelessness issues. We believe that's the best way to get the money to those who are in the business of addressing and supporting those who are experiencing homelessness.
In terms of building and hammers, things like tiny villages have been proposed. Is that the sort of thing that the general plan could encourage?
Yeah, you know, people always say, again, this is like that, bring us your ideas, where do you want to do it? And I think these things can happen. You know, there's a lot of flexibility in our codes and regulations. Things that don't meet the exact letter of the law or the exact letter of our municipal code can be allowed with a planned development permit. There's a lot of ways to deviate from our standard rules and regulations. The key, again, is finding someone who wants to move forward, has the funding, has the land.
Mm-hmm.
So that's usually where the challenge comes.
I just want to read this because I really like it. This comes from the California Department of Housing and Community Development. The housing element update can provide a mechanism to adopt efficient land use strategies such as infill development, mixed-use development, e.g. housing on top of shopping, restaurants, office space, or downtown revitalization. It can also provide a vehicle for local governments to adopt housing and land use strategies that address climate change and reduce greenhouse gas emissions, for example, promoting higher density infill housing for low-income workers or promoting housing along transit corridors, allowing more people to get out of their cars and use public transit. It sounds like that's your vision. Am I correct?
I was saying, yeah, a lot of those concepts and notions were included in the 2030 General Plan in 2011. They don't necessarily always dictate or require, but they certainly created an opportunity for those to, succeed.
Thank you so much. I think we covered most of the things that we wanted to talk about, but, you know, maybe we'll get together again in the future and talk. But thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Brendan Vieg is Director of Community Development for the City of Chico, and Marie Demers is Housing Manager in the Community Development Department. We know you have enormously challenging jobs, and we appreciate your efforts on behalf of the City of Chico. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for your work.
Thank you for having us. And if I could just put a plug for that August 11th.
Oh, please.
11th.
Yes. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I meant
people
to do that.
If people are interested, go to chicohousingelement.com. It's a virtual meeting from 5:30 to 7:30, and we do need you to register. So
and it's,
folks are interested, that'd be great.
Yeah,
August 11th.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having us on.
Thank you.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Thank you.
As we roll down this unfamiliar road, and although this wave is stringing us along, just know you're not alone, 'cause I'm gonna make this place yours.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. We want to tell you about a film premiere and spoken word performance. The film title is Another Norm. It'll be Thursday, July 29th at the Chico Women's Club. Doors open at 7. The program starts at 7:30. There's a $10 suggested donation at the door. Local filmmakers will premiere their latest works at the Women's Club. The evening will open with Trudy Duesenberg's Norm, which is a biographical short film on local pointillist artist Norm Dillinger, whose art and home reflect the joy he finds in life. Stacey Weir and Gerard Ungerman will ask for their latest film, Lost and Found in the Park, Finding Community in Chico's Houseless Camps. And again, that's July 29th. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, we'll hear from Bobby Tryon. Her guests tonight are from the From Ground Up Farm Project. You've been listening to Ecotopia. Contact us at ecotopia@gmail.com, and you can always listen to shows on our website. Thank you for listening.
You are the new day. Yesterday, if you can but prove to me you are the new day, send us on in time for dawn. Let the buds all hail the morning. Love of life will urge me say. Knowing we must bear, thoughts occur that this night might stay yesterday. Thoughts that we as humans mourn, good slow words and end it all, lie around me.
Up next is North State Give and Take. And North State Give and Take is made possible by generous contributions of KCFR supporters, that's you, and by the Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers in the heart of downtown Chico. Cotton Party's been providing friendly service for over 30 years at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling the Cotton Party at 893-4923. And by The Printed Image, providing screen printing and embroidery in Chico since 1980. The Printed Image, open Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and by appointment. More information by calling 530-898-9525. Give and Take. Every Tuesday at 6, I interview, or I do pre-recorded interviews with nonprofits in the North State.